Hello and welcome to the Logistics Podcast. I'm your host, Bonnie Cliff. Thanks for joining us. This is Let's Talk Logistics. Today, I'm joined by the CEO of DHL Supply Chain UK and Ireland, Sol Resnick. You'll of course recognise DHL as the world's leading logistics company, with their iconic red and yellow vans in over 220 countries and territories. DHL has overcome many challenges throughout its 55-year history, including perhaps some of the most arduous ones we have all experienced in the last 5 years, thanks to the pandemic and growing geopolitical instability. My first question to Sol was how DHL has navigated these challenges to its supply chains.
It certainly was a challenging time. I actually was based in Australia at the time. I came to the UK at the end of 21, so the tail end of COVID. But what we experienced is that, I suppose from a positive point of view for all of us in the industry, is that people started talking about supply chain and logistics in a way that they hadn't before. You know, normally if you'd be at a barbecue on a weekend with your friends, nobody really knew what you did. When COVID came and suddenly people couldn't find their basic essentials in the quantities that they were used to, things like toilet paper, as we all know, then suddenly it was, well, what's going on? What's with the supply chains? And you found yourself explaining the issues that are related to all the congestion, all the issues we had around the world and lack of supply. Where DHL was in a fortunate position is that, yes, we were able to respond quickly, but through our global networks, we had better visibility of what was coming, what wasn't coming, what was available, what wasn't available. Working with our colleagues in our global forwarding and express divisions, we could certainly understand how best to get product from A to B, globally I'm talking about. And also, we were able to work with our customers. So the biggest challenge in some ways was actually around people, because some of our sectors got almost decimated, you could say, in airline travel as one example, motor manufacturing to some extent in others with shortage of microchips, albeit at slightly different stages. And where we were able to pivot incredibly well is to move people from one sector or business unit into another. So our grocery sector, our grocery BU, which is a substantial business unit, had a great requirement and demand for labor at that time. And what we could do is we could shift people from one source to another. So we weren't having to make people redundant. We could keep people gainfully employed and also meet customers' expectations. So the predictability that was and is currently what was what you would expect and what is currently in line with what you'd expect at that time went out the window. So you had these massive peaks and troughs in different sectors and different spaces. But having a broad, diverse portfolio enabled us to pivot really well from a labor and supply point of view. We also then were faced in the UK with Brexit at a similar time. So we also found that not only did we have these supply chain challenges, we also had labor challenges, drivers, et cetera. So we pivoted there as well, where we created our own driver training center, where we could train drivers or upgrade licenses for individuals to get them, you know, on different category vehicles so that they could get licensed for that as well. And that meant that while we struggled in some ways, we weren't as in a difficult position as some other logistics companies because we really were able to bring up our own drivers through the network and train them accordingly.
So for DHL, supporting employees through training was an essential part of their COVID strategy. But not every logistics company is lucky enough to have as many assets as DHL. Therefore, collaboration and sharing resource was the key to overcoming disruption.
So DHL is in the enviable position, I suppose you could say, because through our organization, our global organization, Deutsche Post, and our global forwarding express division specifically, we have, you know, we are represented in every single country around the world. Within our supply chain, it's lesser countries, but in very big volumes in the countries we're in. I think we have 200,000 almost employees across the globe. So we're less reliant on certainly our competitors of ours for collaboration. But what we do is work with other industry players who can support our customers' requirements where they may be better placed than us. And that could be in final mile distribution in some cases for small carton deliveries, albeit we may work with our sister companies in that space. But also in things like labor, we would generally have between 15 to 20% or 25% of our labor force on agency labor at any given time, which gives us the flexibility to peak with our customer demands and seasonal demands. And so we work with a number of key strategic partners in that space who provide us that. And we also work with airline carriers globally where we're required. Obviously, they're a major part of our industry, as well as shipping lines, as well as port to store or port to facility transport hauliers as well. So we work with a wider range wide range of suppliers and partners, and in some cases they may well be competitors of ours, but ultimately, you know, it's about servicing our customers as best we can. And sometimes our customers will have two or three strategic partners, of which we'll be one, and then we work in collaboration with those companies to ensure that our customer gets what ultimately they're looking for.
Collaboration and cooperation are not the only lessons that we took from the pandemic. Logistics companies had to completely change their operations to adapt to social distancing rules and lockdowns, some learning the hard way that their way of working lacked sufficient flexibility. Here's Sol to share some more pandemic learnings.
I think one of the things is about supply stability and having the right amount of quantity in country when required. Over-reliance on one source of supply has clearly been seen as a weakness in certain supply chains. So you've seen a lot of our customers, a lot of manufacturers, OEMs, who historically may have been reliant solely on, say, China supply, now looking at near-sourcing their supply or multi-sourcing, where they'll have ability to procure products from more than just one country, and giving them greater built-in resilience into their supply chains. That's something that's definitely come about. What we also saw during the pandemic, which is now leveling off somewhat, is that it kind of created this tidal wave where companies didn't have enough inventory of certain lines, so they ordered more and more, and their safety stock was certainly, let's say, hypothetically, 42 days, 6 weeks. They may have said, well, look, we really should have 8 weeks or 10 weeks, in which case they placed orders for more volume than what they were doing. But they weren't doing that alone in isolation. A lot of manufacturers around the globe were doing similarly. So then what you saw is a bottleneck at source and supply. And then there was no lack of supply. So what are that? There was no supply, rather, because there was only so much product that the guys could produce in so much time. So what ultimately happened is that people ordered more and more products, and then it created even more challenges. And that's when you got soaring prices on freight rates and air freight rates, etc. That's come down now. Companies have now stabilized what their right level of working capital in inventory is. And it's more about sourcing from the right amount of locations and the strategically correct amount of locations, and ensuring that they have access to that inventory on a nearer shore basis, which seems to be the common trend or the more developing trend for certain organizations in this part of the world. So that's been one learning. The other learning has been about the ability to cross-train people to have similar systems and technologies available at different business units, different regions, different parts of the country, so that people can work from one sector to another sector, from one warehouse to another warehouse, and still be able to fulfill their functions or their jobs without having to be retrained and reskilled each time. And that's also been something that we've taken on board. So a lot more standardization of systems and applications where possible.
So nearshoring has benefits for inventory management, yes, but it's also great for cutting your carbon emissions. Sourcing products from overseas, especially where air freight is involved, can result in hugely inflated cargo costs as well as unnecessary usage of fossil fuels. So how does Sol feel about the current trends towards nearshoring and deglobalization?
Deglobalization is a point for debate, I suppose. You know, we still believe very strongly as an organization that globalization is good for all economies. It helps uplift from the poorest and gives opportunities for all across the world to benefit from trade and global trade. So I'm still an optimist. I am an optimist, and I'm still very optimistic that global trade will continue to develop despite some of the macro political challenges or macroeconomic challenges we see at the moment and political challenges we see at the moment. Having said that, nearshoring just means that other economies will also have a chance, I believe, to develop their manufacturing capability, develop opportunities for their employees and their people, rather, to ensure that global supply chains are de-risked, but at the same time give opportunities for regions that may not otherwise historically have been able to produce whatever the consumer products are, the chance to do that. And we're seeing more of that. So we're seeing a lot of our customers saying, well, we used to source only from China. We're now going to source from China and Turkey, or China and Brazil, or India and Brazil, whatever it may be. And the benefit of that is that you're spreading the work around the world. We're not too reliant as countries on one particular global superpower or one country as a supply point, which then means you're removing bottlenecks in the supply chain because you have flexibility. So nearshoring makes sense. It does make sense, provided obviously cost and quality and service are where you expect them to be. But at the same time, I don't believe we've seen the end of globalization. I think that'll continue, albeit there may have been some hiccups along the way. I think, you know, it'll continue and we'll we'll hopefully see the kind of growth we have seen over the last 30 years going forward, the next 30 and 40 years and beyond.
The workforce in 30 or 40 years will obviously look drastically different from the one of today. Nonetheless, evaluating your impact on the planet is an ongoing process, as Sol is about to explain.
We were the first large global logistics organization to state a claim of having a zero emissions target by 2050. And we did this some 15 years ago already. So we've been monitoring and working towards reducing our carbon emissions for some time now. Sometimes it feels like companies use this as a bit of lip service, but within our organization, it's absolutely front of mind. So we have three bottom lines, which is our customers, our shareholders, and our employees. And then a few years ago, we added our fourth, which is the planet, and how do we be a sustainable partner to the planet. So across all our BUs, we have metrics to ensure that we're reducing our emissions and targets. So we had a target by 2020, we have a target by 2030, a progress target, and then zero emissions by 2050. And we've achieved each milestone along the way, and we'll continue to do so. From our perspective, all our new warehouses, wherever we put them up, are carbon neutral. So we make use of solar paneling, amongst others, effective lighting, et cetera, to ensure that we're compliant from a warehouse point of view. But the biggest user of emissions, or of carbon rather, for us is transport. So for us, we recognize that you cannot go from 100% to 0% overnight. It's a process that you have to get to. And that's kind of akin to what I said about from the group. We've hit milestones along the way. But here in the UK, where we have a significant transport fleet, we are working on various modes of carbon reduction technologies to get us to our ultimate goal of zero emissions. So we're using things like HVO, hydrated vegetable oil, where we can, and that's also subject to availability of things like palm oil. We're using, and we have purchased and continue to purchase, significant volumes of biogas vehicles, whether that be LNG or CNG, both in Ireland and the UK. And that'll enable us to have a circular economy with the waste, but to massively reduce the amount of footprint that we're creating. And then through our sister companies, we have electric vehicles for local divisions or for final mile as carton deliveries. But we've also procured four battery electric vehicles for long haul. We took the first four Volvo trucks in the country about 2-3 months back now, and we'll continue to progress buying those as well. And ultimately, globally, we're also working on what hydrogen could do for us and hydrogen fuel cells over time. But it's absolutely a priority for us. It's something we speak to and our customers expect from us. And more importantly, our customers' customers, the consumers, expect it, especially the younger generations coming through. For them, it's a non-negotiable that we're on that path. And I can say from a DHL point of view, it's something that from our global CEO down, we talk about it a lot. And we're actually putting money behind ourselves to back ourselves. The group committed 7 billion euros a couple of years back on driving down our carbon emissions. And all of us are challenged by our groups to how we can find ways to mitigate or reduce our carbon emissions.
As Sol said, the younger generations entering the workforce consider it non-negotiable to have a robust sustainability strategy. So it's not just a benefit for the planet. It could benefit your long-term aspirations for your workforce.
I think some organizations treat it as a nice to have. But in due course, and I think that'll be quite soon, it'll be a hygiene factor. Our customers will expect you to have safe practices like we always have. And just like you have safe practices, they'll expect you to have ESG targets and carbon neutrality as a given, not as a nice to have. And from our staff perspective, the people we're hiring now, they don't want to work for an organization that is a big emitter. They don't want to work for an organization that is, seen as a global enemy of ESG targets or science-based targets. They want to work for forward-thinking organizations who are proud of their outputs and are committed to reducing carbon emissions. So that is one aspect. The other aspect is our industry has evolved quite significantly over the last number of years to try find ways to substitute activities which were historically very manually intensive to become more automation reliant or more capital intensive. And that's not to say, just very clearly, that's not to say we want to reduce our workforce. In fact, that's the opposite. We want to grow our workforce significantly. But what we want to do is reduce our reliance on people to do menial and repetitive tasks, which are perhaps not healthy and safe for them in the long term anyway. And if we can find robotics and automation solutions to do that, then that will alleviate that requirement on people. It'll give us a chance to reskill those people and to put people to use or to activities which are more useful for their capabilities. But more importantly, we can also hire additional people into our organization who are who may not have historically seen supply chain as an opportunity to do electrical engineering or mechanical engineering or things like that, where they've trained different skills. But now we will have a need. We have a need currently, and we will have a greater need in future for those kind of skills coming into our organization. And that then means that in 10, 15, 20 years' time, we'll have more automation, not less. So we'll have more requirements for people of that skill base, not less. And we'll continue to bring in those kind of people into our organization to help them grow and help them grow our organization simultaneously.
Thanks to Saul for sharing his insights with the podcast today. You can find more information on DHL services, both on the national and international level, by visiting dhl.com. Thanks for listening to the Logistics Podcast. Keep it moving.